If you are a weekend surfer, a pro surfer, or like me, an urban surf addict, and you'd like to know the nitty-gritty about the behind the scenes of surfing, this is the podcast for you. In each episode of Amongst the Waves, I bring you guests and their stories of how being involved in the surfing industry has not always been a direct path filled with the glamour you see on Instagram. These are their own stories in their own words from people who live and love surfing. Are you a surfer on the qualifier series? Do you want to improve your ranking and know the secrets to having the mindset of a pro surfer on the championship tour? I've created a guide for you and it's called The 3 Ways to Overcome the Mental Battles of Professional Surfing. And you can get your free copy in my bio on Instagram. You can find me there at Tanya A. Carroll. Turning the worst day of your life into your best is no easy feat, but sometimes there is simply no other option. In Brett Connellan's case, this day included the moment every surfer's worst nightmare became his reality when he was attacked by a great white shark. As the light was fading at Bombo Beach on the evening of the 30th of March 2016, Brett was inches from death. He had lost 3/4 of his left quad, and emergency responders on the scene were sure Brett would not make it. Fortunately, the cards fell in Brett's favour, and he managed to pull through with the help of a brave friend, timely emergency support, and a healthy serving of luck. The events that saved Brett's life were not lost on him, and that perspective was needed as he faced a long and challenging road to recovery. With the bleak outlook prescribed to him by doctors, it was evident that Brett's life, as he knew it, would never be the same. These moments in time are pivotal in any person's life, as they often lead to a questioning of purpose and identity. However, what Brett did not know at this time was that the following months were even more life-changing than just the injury itself. The recovery forced Brett to climb a new mountain, in his words, and develop a different mindset towards resilience, which helped him defy the odds to be able to walk again and eventually get back in the water and do what he loves most, surfing. Although this may sound like the perfect end to Brett's story, it was only the beginning. Brett soon realised that the lessons he learned through his recovery could be applied to all areas of his life. This has pushed him to be the best version of himself, both personally and professionally. This new version of Brett, fueled by purpose, drives him to use his unique and powerful story to help others make the most out of their journeys. Hi there. Welcome to the podcast today, Brett. How are you going?
Yeah, really good. Thanks. Thanks heaps for having me on.
Yeah, no problem. I heard about your story when your life-changing day happened, and we'll clarify that and get into more about what that actually was. But I'm interested about how in you as a person and what you were like before that happened and what happened after that, because I think I come from a background of really believing in what soul purpose is. And I don't think many things happen in life by accident, whereas some people would look at what's happened to you and probably have a little bit of like sympathy and pity for you maybe, and because what did happen was probably 1 in a million chance, and you'll be able to give us the statistics on that, but not something that happens to many people in a lifetime. And I think that happens for a reason to certain people. Do you feel like that is what has happened, or that would kind of describe why you think has happened to what happened to you?
Yeah, I think a lot of things you said there. A lot of things you said there kind of sum up what I talk about a lot. It is, you know, the person I was before, the person I am now, and, you know, what's caused that. And it is about the, you know, something happening for a reason, which leads to a change in purpose. And really purpose, I think, is one of the biggest things that has changed who I am, not only in what I hope to do, but even in just what I do day to day, and, you know, the type of person I am, and so many other things. And, you know, I think it's really interesting sort of way to kick it off is talking about purpose and, you know, the person I was before and how much that's changed. Because I think at the face of it, when you do go through a life changing, you know, event or incident, experience, whatever it might be, a lot of people always expect to kind of get back to the person that they were. And I mean, you and I were talking just before about how, you know, we hope things go back to normal, but sometimes normal isn't always the best. Normal seems comfortable for a lot of people, and for a lot of people, normal and that comfortable place is where you were before. But for me and what I've learned, you know, over the past 6 years is what you can learn out of growth and what that can do for you and how much more power that holds in bringing you new purpose and something else in life that you may not have experienced or even considered before. And that's kind of where I am now. I mean, the type of person I was before was a surfer. Like I always say, for a majority of my life, I spent just chasing waves and being a surfer. And that's something that, you know, some people can relate to. For me, I was very, very deep in surfing, not only just as a sport and doing it every day and competing and everything like that, but professionally, like with work. My first job was as a surf coach. I ended up having my own surf school, worked in a surf shop.
Surf shop.
Even, you know, went and did surfing studies at university. So
it's completely immersed.
Yeah, completely immersed. Like it's where all my friends were. It's everything I thought about all day was just to do with surfing. And I didn't really care about anything else. That was my one and only purpose. And that's where you talk about purpose. Mine was around surfing and making that a huge part of my life. It's something that I wanted to do from the age of 11 when I first stepped on a surfboard. I was like, I don't know in what capacity, but I want surfing to be a major part of my life. And I think for a lot of people, they, you know, especially if you are doing competitions and stuff like that, the dream is really to surf on the world tour and to chase that sort of thing because it sounds so amazing. But I'd kind of set myself up that I could kind of chase, you know, whether it be like in industry or something like that, that I really just wanted that to be, you know, my one and only thing. And it felt so natural to me. And it was something that I loved doing and something that was a huge part of my life. And it still is today, but just in a different capacity, I suppose you'd say.
Why do you think surfing has that? Because I've been around this. So I've been a surf coach now for 2 years. Loved the sport since for as long as I can remember. I grew up in Canberra, but we used to spend a lot of time. We had a caravan in the house down at Tathra. So spent my time on the beaches, not necessarily in the water, but around that culture and wanting to be part of it, but kind of sitting on the fringe of it. Why do you think surfing as a culture is so addictive and so immersive, like you talk about? Because I've talked to a lot of people in this industry and they all say the same thing.
Yeah, I think because it just has, it has something for everyone. I think surfing, it's obviously a challenge. Like if you talk to anyone who has taken up surfing, especially people that take it up, you know, later in life, they talk about how difficult it is and how challenging it is compared to a lot of other things. And I think people who do like to challenge themselves like that aspect of it. Obviously, you know, it's a really great place to switch off and be away from, you know, regular life. I always say for myself, if I'm in need of sort of getting away from my phone or something like that, surfing is the best way to do that because it's the it's the only thing I can do where I can leave like my phone in the car and not worry about it for 2-3 hours. If I was to go for a walk around the block and leave my phone at home, it'd feel like I'm missing a limb. Like it has that quality to it where you don't think about anything else except for what you're doing then and there. And obviously, you know, the connection to nature. I think the surf community is a pretty amazing thing as well. I have this take about surfing where I do see it as quite a selfish sport in essence, because it is a single person sport. You go out there and you want to get the best wave for yourself and you
get jealous. It's competitive.
It's very competitive, but the community itself is something that's amazing. Like, and I think a lot of that it comes from that connection that we have to the sport and it is easy to feel supported and connected to that community. So, I mean, I don't think I have necessarily a single definitive answer to, you know, why surfing is so appealing, because I think it does just lend itself to a lot of different personalities and people and walks of life. And I think that's the appeal for a lot of people, especially from the outside looking in, but especially for people that are lucky enough to do it.
So you said you got on the board at the age of 11. At what point did you think, I'm going to make this my career? In whatever aspect that is, whether being that's a professional surfer or, like you said, in the background areas somehow.
I'm not sure if I can kind of put it down to a date or a point in time, because it was kind of like before that I did a lot of other sports. Like I'd play soccer, tennis, you know, you name it. I've played pretty much everything. Like I've even played water polo and stuff like that, which a lot of people are like, I don't know how you got into that. Like it's not even a big sport over here. But as soon as I picked up surfing, I dropped all that stuff and was like, this is me, this is my sport. And like I'd probably say from, you know, very early on I knew I wanted to compete and do all that side of things. But as you grow through life, I think you adjust depending on what you're doing, and whether it's going through school and trying to figure out where it fits there, or competing. And competing in surfing is tough. And my dad used to always say this, he's like, you need to be okay with losing, because not only in the first 20 minutes does half the field go home, but only one person wins. And that's a really difficult thing to kind of grapple with. So you know, you go through this journey of surfing competitions and losing a lot, but you still have to kind of assure yourself that you're good enough to at least have another crack and try the next competition and do all of that. And that's kind of a point that I was at. I think my surfing kind of developed pretty late. I wasn't until I was sort of 17, 18 years old where I really came into my surfing and, you know, made a bit of a name for myself locally and started really trying to compete. The unlucky thing for me is that by the time I got to 17, 18 years old, when the pro juniors are really kind of the apex of competition, there was only three events at that point just because they dwindled yeah. so much. And I didn't really have that opportunity, but that kind of forced me to look at those other things like, you know, the starting my own surf school and working in the surf shop and things like that, where I knew I kind of had a plan B, but in the back of my head, I was always looking at, you know, what competitions I could surf in, you know, how I could get my name out there and keep trying to pursue that. And it was always a constant sort of thing for me.
You were in the media before the injury?
Yeah, little bits and pieces. I suppose just mainly local stuff. I come from a pretty small town, and it's kind of the, you know, big fish, little pond thing, because, and that's really a very South Coast way to look at things, because there's a lot of really, really talented surfers from, you know, the South Coast, New South Wales, and even down to Victoria that I think talent tends to get a little bit overlooked here because you're not in a major center like Sydney or the Gold Coast.
Yeah.
And I think it's easy to kind of fall into that and become, you know, just a good local surfer.
Yeah.
So I think there was kind of always that aspect to trying to break through. And like, I was lucky that there were some good role models to look to in, you know, from the immediate local area, like Reese Bombassi, who, you know, came really close to qualifying a few times, Dean mm-hmm. Bowen, like the Wright family, Sally Fitzgibbons, they're all within, you know, a couple of kilometers of my town of Kiama here. So there were some good role models to kind of look towards and see, you know, what that path
what could be possible.
Kind of looked like. Yeah. And I think that was one thing that really drove me as well.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about what happened that day.
Yes.
So 6 years ago?
Coming up to 6 years ago this March.
Wow. And just a regular normal day, went out for a surf.
Yeah, it's funny. Like I always kind of preface my story with saying, like, first of all, I'm just a normal guy. And second of all, it was just a normal day. Cause I think a lot of people expect, you know, to see these signs or whatever it is. And when I do recount it, I think there's probably a few things you pick up on where it wasn't a normal day. Like the reason mm-hmm. I went for a surf that day is because I'd kind of had a rough day at work. I woke up at 2 a.m. that morning to a phone call from my boss saying the shop had been broken into. So I spent most of the day just kind of dealing with the break-in, which is not what you want to be doing on any average day of work. So I went for a surf that afternoon to kind of just wash that off. I didn't really know what the waves were going to be like, but I knew what the conditions were. And I called a good friend of mine, Joel, on the way home when I was driving back from work and just said, I'm going to go for a surf out Bombo, which is just the local beach that I kind of grew up surfing. And just said, yeah, I'll be out there. And he said, yeah, cool. I was about to go down to the river, but might come for a surf. He was about to go down to the river with his partner, Aggie, at the time. The funny thing, I always bring this up as well about Joel and the type of person he is. And Joel's one of my best mates. I actually just spoke to him then about going for a surf later on. I've lived with Joel. I've known him for a long time. He's spent a lot of time filming me and taking photos. So he's always been there as far as my surfing goes. But he's the type of friend or the type of person, I'm sure everyone has someone like this in their life, where if you call them to go for a surf or do something, they'll show up either late or just not show up at all. Joel is that person. And he's the person that I, you know, trusted the call on, you know, the biggest, you know, day in my life, I suppose, up until that point. And I ended up just going for a wave. I was surfing by myself for about 30 minutes before I looked back at the beach and actually see Joel walking down. So that's obviously a point in his favor so far. He's actually made it.
And yours as well. Yeah,
definitely. So Joel got out in the water and we were surfing a little bit further down the beach from where the crowd was. That's one thing that I kind of tried to do a lot is just get waves to myself. I'd rather surf, you know, a closeout to myself than sit in a crowd of 30 people. So I was surfing down the beach a little bit and the waves were pretty fun. Joel and I were just sharing a few waves for a while, having a chat. I was telling him about the day I'd had, telling him about the break-in and things like that. And Waves are actually really fun, and I was feeling a lot better sort of, you know, after half an hour of surfing with Joel. And that's kind of the one of the things I love about surfing, is it gives you an opportunity to go out there and kind of just really clear your mind. Like, you know, sitting out the back gives you a chance to chat to your friends. And you know, I think that's one big thing that I always say, is surfing has always been that for me. But
perspective.
Yeah, exactly. It gives you the opportunity to do that. So yeah, after about half an hour, Joel had caught a wave. He was probably about 100 meters down the beach. And I was just sitting out the back, kind of reflecting on the day, like thinking back, thinking about how bad it had been, but saying, you know, at least I've been able to come for a surf, feeling a lot better. You know, this is much better than, you know, where I was an hour ago. Yeah. It was honestly, as I was kind of having that thought, I was looking back towards the beach where Joel's girlfriend was sitting, and the sun was sort of just starting to set behind the clouds there over the mountain. When I got hit from my right side by what felt like a bus.
So you didn't see it, didn't feel it?
Didn't see anything, didn't feel anything. I'd been thrown off my board. And before I could actually, you know, figure out what had gone on, I tried to look around, but then looked down and there's a shark biting my left leg.
Yeah.
And for me, this is the moment that, you know, stood still, the moment that I think a lot of people that go through a traumatic event, this is where they say, you know, 5 seconds,
time stops.
5 minutes, time stops. Yeah. It's that sort of feeling there. And it's an incredible feeling, that, and one where you get to take in like a lot of really small details, like things that are going on. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, they're like, what's the first thing that was going through your mind? And I always say, like, I don't know, if you put yourself in my shoes, you know, you're just sitting there, you get hit from your right side, you look down, there's a shark biting, you're like, what's the first thing that you're going to do? And a lot of people usually respond with some sort of four-letter word, or a collection of four-letter words.
I don't think you even have time to process that. I think you just go straight into survival.
And that's the thing. Like, people are always surprised when I say there was actually nothing going through my mind. I was just frozen. Yeah. Like, your instincts of the fight, flight, or freeze kicks straight in. Yeah. You don't have time to make any conscious decisions. So I was really just frozen in that moment there, trying to figure out what I could do. One thing that I've learned afterwards, and the interesting thing that actually makes sense about that whole situation, is that in fight, flight, or freeze, freeze isn't a final option. It's just fight or flight on hold. So it's an information gathering exercise. And that's why a lot of people have these vivid memories of what happened to them in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So I could take in all the really fine details. Like, I remember what the feel of the shark's skin was like as I was trying to push it away. You know, the fact that there was no sound, which is a strange thing because I found out later, and I know I was shouting for help. Even the look in the shark's eyes, which had, you know, no emotion. It's just kind of two black dots looking back at me. And that, for me, especially that image of the shark, is one where I always make sure I say that it's not one that invokes fear in me, as I'm sure it would with a lot of other people having that vivid memory. But for me, it actually invokes a lot of respect for sharks, and they're standing in, you know, the food chain, they're standing in the environment, because they are really incredible creatures. They are very, very good at what they do. There's reasons that they've been around for, you know, so many thousands centuries. Of years. Yeah. It's because they
and they're at the top of the chain.
Exactly. And, you know, for me to get that feeling of respect from that moment is probably a strange way to do it, but it's definitely a massive takeaway that I had from it, and something that gives me a lot of respect for sharks today.
Do you think that has helped you, that moment has helped you be able to recover and not seemingly not have PTSD from it and be able to get back into the water?
Yeah,
but definitely. You've framed it in your brain in a way that's, I mean, negative in the moment, but has so many other positive aspects to it.
Yeah, definitely. And I've always been aware of the conversation around sharks, and have always been pretty, you know, open to looking at, you know, sharks and the creature for what they are. I think, you know, as a surfer, you know the risks of going in the water, and that's something I was always comfortable with. So for me, it was never an issue going back in the water and, you know, feeling any malice towards sharks or changing my opinions, because I'd always felt that way towards them. Yeah. Like, I know that my situation was just pure bad luck, like being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that's not something you can hold against another person or another creature.
And that's the universe.
Exactly. That's a big thing for me in the way that I looked at it. So it definitely helped me with, you know, all those things that you spoke about in helping me get back in the water and all of that. So I suppose in that moment, it's an interesting thing. And the 5 seconds that last 5 minutes was crazy, because it honestly felt like it lasted a long time. And I felt like I was actually doing nothing. I was like, why am I letting this shark just bite me?
Hmm. When it's just a matter of seconds.
Exactly. And it's, you kind of get to the point where you're like, I need to do something. And, you know, a lot of people who think they know about sharks are probably screaming as they're listening to this podcast saying, why don't you punch the shark? And the unfortunate thing about punching sharks is it's really hard to punch through water.
Yeah.
And, you know, first punch I tried didn't even make an impact. So it really just left me with one other option, which is try and, you know, pull away from the shark to try and flee.
Yeah.
Which is what I did. And that turned out to be the biggest mistake I made in that moment. It makes total sense what I did, trying to pull away from the shark. But the unfortunate thing for us as humans is we're pretty fragile. Like this, you know, skin sac that our bodies are held in can't really,
in comparison to the teeth of a shark. Yes,
exactly. It can't take that much force. So as I pulled away from it, it just separated that chunk of leg that it was holding in its mouth from my body, which sounds like a bad thing, but I didn't feel anything in that moment. I didn't even look at it. I just thought to myself, I have an opportunity here to try and swim to the beach and, you know, try and escape this situation. I did just that. I put my head down and just tried to swim as hard as I could. And I'd only got about 20 meters further in, and I had a thought come over me, which is, you know, I wonder if this shark's going to come back a second time. And it was lucky I had that thought, because I look over my right shoulder just in time to see it coming back. And I put both my hands out to try and stop it. And my right hand, luckily enough, landed on its nose. My left hand wasn't so accurate and fell into its mouth. And I lost a bit of skin on and some teeth, but was able to pull it out just before it bit down. Mm-hmm. And the shark just pushed me through the water for the next 20 meters or so. Again, with immense power that only kind of added to that respect that I have for them. And as it's pushed me through the water, I'm again trying to figure out how I'm going to escape from this. And I see a wave approaching and thinking this is kind of my one and only opportunity to get out of this situation. I say to myself, when the wave hits me, I have to try and push the shark to one side and hope that the white water kind of throws us around enough underwater that it separates me completely. And luckily enough, that was the case. The wave actually pushed me in quite a way. And when I stood up the next time, I was only in about waist deep water. And this time when I look up, I don't see the shark for the third time, luckily. I actually see my mate Joel paddling towards me as fast as he can. So I suppose all that stuff I said about him earlier, I need to take back.
Take back. I'm sure you've said your thank yous.
Yeah, definitely. Which is an image in my mind that, you know, I'm very, very grateful for. It's one that I think about regularly. And that for me is the image where I'm like, okay, I think everything is hopefully going to be okay. And
standing, and I'm in waist deep water. So those are signs to me that I'm relatively safe.
Relatively safe, exactly. And I'd lost my board in that initial impact. When the shark actually hit me from the side, its teeth cut through my leg rope. And when I was knocked off, I was no longer with my board, which is why I had to swim in.
Yeah.
So Joel had to put me on his board and take me to the beach, where he dragged me up on the sand and then ran off to get some help. And
because you're missing your leg and you can't walk.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the issue. But once I got to the beach, I was so exhausted. Like when even the last couple of meters before getting to the sand, I could no longer paddle or help. Like I was really just going into shock at that stage.
Right.
So
adrenaline had completely run out then. And I guess that's when you start to think and go, I've just been attacked by a shark.
Exactly. Yeah. That's kind of that realization where everything gets very, very real. And as Joel, you know, ran off to get some help, I was kind of laying there by myself and had that thought again, just kind of reflecting and going, okay, I know I've been bitten by a shark. I didn't look down at my leg the entire time because I didn't want to go into more shock and lose more blood. Mm-hmm. But I was trying to survey the situation and just saying to myself, okay, I know I've been bitten by a shark. I don't know how bad it is, but, you know, obviously I'm in a lot of trouble. And I was kind of thinking to myself, like, if this is really, really serious, is this actually what it feels like, you know, to die? Like, is this kind of what my last moments are going to feel like? And I kind of weighed up the situation and was trying to just be in that moment and kind of see what that felt like. And for some reason, it didn't feel right. I've no idea why it didn't feel right, because I was very, very close to death in those moments. But just something to me didn't feel like that was my time. And I think
you weren't done.
Yeah. I think it's a good thing I didn't come, like, give into that, because it allowed me just to focus on, you know, what I could do in that moment. Once I decided that no, this didn't feel right, I was like, okay, well, what can I do? And it was really just breathing and trying to stay present. And that's what I started to do then. And that's kind of where my luck started to turn. Like, there's a lot of luck that comes into surviving a shark attack. Not only the bite itself and how close it actually was to my femoral artery.
Where it bites and all that sort of thing. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, there's millimeters in that. But the real luck that I say, you know, having Joel actually come that afternoon.
Yeah.
The fact that his girlfriend at the time came down as well, and she wasn't someone who would come and watch every one of his surfs, but his girlfriend at the time, now wife, Aggie, she's an intensive care nurse. So one of the first people to, you know, come and help out in the situation was well and truly qualified. There was one other person walking along that beach in the afternoon who was also a nurse. So everyone who, you know, applied the tourniquets and did all the first aid on the beach were qualified to do so, made all the right moves, and, you know, not only saved my life, but essentially ended up saving my leg and made a huge impact in the overall, I suppose, outcome of my story, and, you know, helped me be here today. So there is a lot of luck that goes into that. But yeah, they stabilized me on the beach, and then I was eventually airlifted from there to St. George Hospital.
When you say Aggie was an intensive care nurse, when you've spoken to her after the fact, did she just kick into instinct as well?
Yeah, she was saying there's a strange line in between instinct and your job, and then also it being someone that you know. Mm. And it's trying to stay calm and do the things that you know you're supposed to do, but then also seeing that it's someone that, you know, when I was living with Joel, I was living with Aggie as well, so someone she's been very close to. And she's saying that things that were difficult for her was things like calling my mom, which, you know, is a very different thing to do when you have a personal relationship to someone. But ultimately, you know, she's very experienced and very good at her job, and you know, made all the right decisions and did everything correctly, along with Joel and John, the other two that were helping in that whole situation that kind of, yeah, helped with the good outcome.
I'm going to go back a couple of steps. So when you said you, in the moment, when you realised the shark had attached itself to your leg, things were heightened, so you could feel the skin, but you couldn't hear the sound. Mm. And then when you came out of the water, you didn't look down at your leg, or you didn't look down at your leg the whole time. Do you think those are things that help you in that survival state? So the fact that you can't hear yourself screaming, because if you hear yourself screaming, then the subconscious has got the memory of that, but it also increases the level of panic and maybe the sense of feeling, and those other things that were heightened helped you get through that situation.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think one thing that I kind of have looked into a little bit is just basically how our instinct works in situations like that. And it is, like, we're designed that in those critical incidents, we're not making conscious decisions. We just do the things that give us the best chance of survival. Mm. And, you know, things like not remembering the screams and stuff obviously might help later down the track. But everyone, like, the way in which you remember certain traumas can be different depending on who you are and what the actual circumstances were of that as well. So the way in which trauma can replay in people's brains and in their lives can vary depending on what it was and you know, their own experiences as well. But in the actual moment there, like, making the decision to not look down at my leg, as I look back on it, is because I remember watching the Bethany Hamilton documentary and remember her saying the same thing.
Wow.
But in the moment, I wasn't thinking, oh, what would Bethany do in this moment? It's just something that is, you know,
laid in that subconscious.
Yeah, you learn somewhere. And it's enough in there where, you know, you can make a decision under that much pressure that has such a significant impact on whether that outcome is going to be good or bad. But I think it's amazing when you look at all these little things that happen in those critical situations. And, like, I've talked to a lot of other people who have been in situations like that, and they all say that's one thing that they do take away from it is how well your body can, or you as a person can operate under, you know, immense stress and pressure.
Body and mind. Mm. Have you spoken to other, like you just said, people who have been through similar traumas, but particularly anyone, shark attack survivors?
Yeah, there's there's a funny thing that happens when you get bitten by a shark. There's a thing called the bite club, which is a support group for other people who've been bitten by sharks, which is, it was an amazing thing. I didn't know it existed, obviously, until I was in hospital only a couple of days after the attack, and a guy came in and started telling me about when he got attacked by a shark. And I was like, why is this guy telling me this story? Like, it was all very raw for me at that time. And he finished telling me this story about him getting attacked by a shark. And then he basically just said, and this is important that you need to learn how to do this, because we can't bottle this up. Like, we have a support group so we can talk about it, and it is a good thing for us to do. So that was kind of my first
introduction,
not only to someone else who'd been bitten by a shark, but also to how important it is to talk about these experiences, not only for yourself, but that's something I realized later on, to help other people as well.
Yeah. How long was your recovery? When did you, and was there a point in time where you thought I might be permanently disabled from this?
Yeah, I think very early on, like when, I remember when I woke up in hospital and I was, you know, I didn't know the extent of the damage to my leg, but it was just wrapped in bandages and it was just a dull ache, like the entire leg. And I was thinking to myself, like, this is obviously very serious, and had kind of come to a few conclusions that, yeah, I might be in a wheelchair for a very long time. Mm. Not knowing sort of what, like at that point, they hadn't done any operation. They hadn't even really told me what was wrong. I just knew it was that serious. Mm-hmm. And I suppose those expectations, or kind of where you lead, you know, the recovery point to, it varies a lot as you go. Like for me, the sort of where I was at my lowest with expectations was after the doctors had kind of been like, okay, this is the operation we're going to do, and this is what to expect. Because essentially, like, I'd lost 3/4 of my left quad, which is a significant portion of a very significant muscle. So the first thing that they were saying is like, walking is going to be very difficult. And for me, I was like, okay, well, walking's not even something I've ever really thought about losing before. And having something that you take for granted taken away from you is tough. And it kind of goes from there. You go, okay, because walking is going to be difficult. Being active or living an active lifestyle is going to be a challenge. And then I think you can kind of see where this is going. They go, okay, surfing, probably not going to be surfing ever again. Just the challenges that you would face in order to surf with, you know, the deficit in muscle and the lack of mobility and strength in that leg was looked at by them as an insurmountable challenge, where their I suppose reasoning is they were just looking at things like walking and living a basic sort of quality of life again. And that's kind of where I think a lot of the doctors get those prognoses from. But that was something I really struggled with, was not only thinking to myself, it's going to be a long time to get back and, you know, do something simple like walk or run again, but, you know, let alone get in the water and surf. And look, I lived with that as kind of my reality for, you know, a couple of months, even as I was going through basic rehab and learning to walk again. It only took me probably 2 months to be able to walk unassisted. And a big reason for that is because some of the muscle that I did keep in my leg, like that 1/4 that I did keep, it was enough to be able to control my knee, which if you can control your knee, it makes that task a lot easier. Right. I still,
so the VMO is what you kept.
Exactly. So yep. I still struggle a lot with a strength deficit now, but I can control the range of motion, which is key when it comes to not only walking, but doing a lot of other things and surfing. So it's funny, like when, you know, you mentioned how long was the recovery? I don't really know sort of how long the recovery was, because I still am not fully recovered, but I don't think I'll ever be fully recovered. But I suppose there's those points in time which you consider a milestone, and like walking was a very big one. Like I've got some photos and videos of me walking very early on, like first of all just on like a walking frame and being vertical, like that was huge for me at the moment.
How long did you spend horizontal?
I spent 3 weeks laying down before I could get up and just walk on like a walking frame. And then it was kind of just, it was progressing around there. So it was like, I could spend 5 minutes a day standing up, and then it was okay, you can shuffle to the end of the room and back. And it was like, okay, you can walk to the end of the corridor and back. And and you can do a lap of the corridor and then two laps. So it's kind of small bits of progress, but I love that feeling of getting the progress.
Accomplishment.
Exactly. And that for me was a pretty big motivator, where once I kind of saw those incremental, I suppose, improvements, I realized that I'd already kind of been past what I thought my, like that point when I woke up in hospital and was saying, well, it's probably going to be a wheelchair for a long time. And it kind
so
of
you already surpassed that possibility. So your brain went, okay, so I got past that point. So what's to say I can't do the next thing? And then the next thing.
Yeah, exactly. You start to ask yourself, well, not what next? It's not, you know, what people tell you can do. It's, you know, really working with yourself to get there. And, you know, that's, I think, a lot easier said than done. I know a lot of people hear these stories of adversity and they hear that, you know, the person worked hard and they got through it. And like that, you know, when you zoom out and look at someone's recovery, especially like mine, and you can see me go from, you know, laying in bed to shuffling on the walking frame to walking unassisted to running to surfing 5 months after. I think a lot of people think that comes pretty quickly, but there's so many things I learned along the way that helped guide me there. Like there's the great help I got from my physiotherapist, Scott, just around sort of setting those expectations and goals. And that was a big thing for me, because he taught me to set goals that were a lot higher than what you thought. He said, you know, one thing that I'll never forget, he said, people fail not from aiming too high and missing, but aiming from too low.
Yeah.
And that was a big thing for me to realize that I could set surfing as a goal, and whether I was able to surf or not, it didn't actually matter. Because even if I'd be able to get halfway there, that's still further than the goal I probably
originally what you thought
for. And it does help you really look at the process of being able to get to that. And it's like, okay, well, how can I get to the point of surfing again? And it's like, well, I'm not going to be able to do it tomorrow. I'm not going to be able to do it next week. But all I can really do is just focus on it day by day. And the way I broke it down was just saying, what can I do today just to improve on the person I was yesterday? And that was kind of the step-by-step approach that I took. And not every day is improvement. Not every day you're going to go out there and smash another goal. So it is tempered with, you know, a bit of humility and knowing that the setbacks are going to come. But that recovery, you know, in 5 months of being able to get back in the water was so many ups and downs. And that's something that has kind of stuck with me, where I look at that and I look at the recovery and, you know, getting back in the water. And there's a photo of me surfing with my best mate, Nick, after 5 months of being out of the water. And I look at that and just everything that I learned throughout that 5 months was so valuable, not only in that time, but just in everything that I do today. And such a significant moment for me. But, you know, when you talk about, is that recovery done? It's like getting back on the water. I was just surfing on a longboard, which for someone who, you know, had aspirations of making the world
be a professional surfer, a longboard is not where you want to be.
not exactly. Like, I was very grateful to be in the water early on, but again, you kind of get to that point where I'm like, okay, I'm in the water, but what next? Like, here,
can I stand up?
Surfing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the same sort of process happened with my surfing, and it was going from, okay, I want to get down to a regular surfboard. A big one for me was getting barreled again, because I had always loved getting barreled, and that was a big one for me. And it was like, okay, can I get back to competing? And then it was to win an event, and it kind of just snowballed a little bit from there. And that's kind of where I got to the point of what we talked about right at the start, where I was doing all of these things based on surfing. Like, I was wanting to get back to a point where I was at before. And I kind of got to the stage where I'd competed again, you know, obviously not at the level I was before, but happy to be there. And I kind of had to take a step back and be like, well, am I still going to make the world tour? Probably not. Like, it's a harsh reality, but it's one that I had to be okay with, especially from very early on. I could easily have set myself the goal of making the world tour, but I wanted to be realistic and kind of look at what my life now had in it. And that's where I kind of separated the person I was before and the person I am now. And that's why I always say surfing, for me, it still has a major part in my life. It's something I do every single day still. And I still think about it a lot. I still surf. I still have a lot of my life in that way, you know, in that culture. But it's not in the same way that I did before. It's not everything that I have. I kind of explain it like there's two mountains. Like my entire life, I was climbing this mountain of becoming a professional surfer and making that my entire life. And when I was bitten by the shark, I tumbled all the way to the bottom of that mountain. As I was going through the recovery and building back up, it's like I was walking back up that mountain. And as I got to a similar level to I was before, I kind of had a chance to look up and look around. I look across at the next mountain over, and that was the mountain that I was climbing before. I was actually climbing a mountain
now. A different mountain.
It was different, but so much higher. A big thing for me was not saying that the life that I had before wasn't going to go anywhere, but this new life and a lot of things that I now had held a lot more purpose, and it gave me something else that the previous life didn't. And when I looked at it like that, it really helped me identify that I can still cherish the person I was before, but look at everything that I have now and what can I do to make this my new life in a way, I suppose. And that's kind of where it does link back to what we talked about earlier.
Yeah. So not like give yourself time to mourn what might have been, but who knows if it actually would have been that anyway.
Yeah,
because you don't know, and you'll never know that. So exactly. Make the most of the opportunities that you've got with what you've got right now.
Yeah, definitely. And like that, again, that's not something that you learn overnight. That still took me a couple of years just to come to that realization. Yeah. But one big thing that I now had was, I suppose, a story. I had experience that I didn't have before. And as I kind of went through my recovery, one thing that really helped me was looking to other people who'd been through something significant, not necessarily a shark attack, but a setback in life. And as I kind of looked around, I saw that almost everyone you know has been through something which has been life-changing. And
A metaphorical shark attack.
Exactly. Like, that's the biggest thing that I realized is it doesn't have to be a shark attack that causes these setbacks. Like, we'll all go through setbacks at some stage, but it's not about what happens to you. It's about how you respond. It's about what you do afterwards. And that for everyone is really how you be remembered. Like, that's the legacy you leave. It's how you respond to a lot of these things. There's a special place in, I suppose, the human mind for admiring resilience and overcoming adversity. And That's something that we'll all have to do at some point in life. And I realized that, yeah, my adversity was very unique in the fact that it was a shark attack. And that's something that I could actually use to tell that story so then I could teach other people things that I had learned along the way. Because so many times we will, you know, run into these roadblocks or have these things happen in our lives, but we don't have the prior experience that we find it very difficult to work through it ourselves because we don't know what to do. We haven't been there. So looking to other people for that, whether it be inspiration, motivation, or just tangible things that they did, is a very useful thing. And it's what worked for me and what works for a lot of other people.
Do you think it gave you relatability?
In a strange way. Like I was talking to someone the other day, they're like, it's interesting how I talk to someone who was bitten by a shark, something that I could never put myself in the shoes of. But again, you kind of speak and put things in a way where it is relatable. Yeah. And that's the biggest thing that I'd say to a lot of people is that you know you don't have to go through a shark attack to learn these things. We'll all go through our own version of that one day, but again, it's not about what it is that happened to you, it is how you respond. And I think that is a big thing that a lot of people do relate to, because we've all, you know, when you look back at those setbacks, you kind of picture, you know, it might be that feeling of grief or loss, or you know, not necessarily just always in, you know, grief and loss of life, but that can be in, you know, grief and loss of purpose, identity, relationship,
career.
Exactly.
Yeah, especially at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a big thing for a lot of people. So it's all about that process of overcoming that and, you know, coming out the other side of it, having either learned something, grown, or become a better person. That's something we can all do in those situations.
Physically, where are you at now? Is there anything that eludes you from being able to do?
A single leg squat on my left leg, but I'm not sure if that will ever happen.
Who wants that anyway?
I mean, who knows? I might get there one day. It's funny, with a lot of people ask that question, but in relation to surfing, like, well, how do you surf now compared to before as a percentage? And I find it really hard to quantify because I just surf differently.
Yeah.
But there's things that I was really good at doing before, like more progressive surfing, doing airs and stuff, that I don't do as well now. A big part of that is just the lack of confidence and not wanting to hurt myself again.
Right, because you've got more to protect now because it's weaker. So you do have to naturally protect it more. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think because I've focused on more basic surfing, I could surf, you know, traditional A to B competition surfing a little bit better. And I've probably had better competition results, not necessarily on as big a stage, but I think I've surfed better heats since the attack. So it's funny, a lot of people always look at surfing, but I think it's amazing how the body can overcome these things and adapt to what's there. I've found that doing sort of other challenges, and a lot of it comes down to a lot of sort of endurance stuff, has been a great way to test where my body's at. And a big part of that is to kind of look at what was promised to me after those early operations and say, well, you know, if I was told that I, you know, was going to struggle to walk again, I'm going to go and do the Oxfam 100K walk. And that's something I did a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I ran a marathon last year. I'm going to paddle the Molokai this year. So it's not so much what can I do. It's trying to figure out what I might not be able to do and either proving that it's possible or not. And I think a lot of that comes down to mindset and preparation rather than what is physically possible. Might not be able to say the same about a single leg squat, but it's an interesting thing that I'm having a lot of fun sort of exploring.
I think it's an incredible gift that you've been given that opportunity when, like, I think that's looking at your potential and what is the body, like you said, what is the body actually capable of? So your body's learning how to reroute around its disability, because clearly it's a disability not to have that full quad in some respects, but learning how much more capable you are in other things and other areas that you might not have had that opportunity to explore before the attack.
Yeah, definitely. And that's been a big thing, is kind of looking at other parts of my life, which I kind of maybe not so much neglected, but didn't consider before. And there's so much more to life that I've found than just surfing. And that's another thing that a lot of people say, like, oh, you're going to get back and try and surf competitively or make the world tour. I'm like, again, surfing is a big part of my life, but I don't look at it in that way before. I've found that, you know, since the attack and realizing that there was a possibility that I couldn't surf again, I had to look around and be like, well, what can I do in life that can give me the same sort of feelings that surfing does? And having a bit of a look around, I was able to find other things to help supplement, especially when I couldn't do it, but supplement those feelings that surfing gave me. And they've become, you know, decent parts of my life now. Things like I took up golf mainly just to help me walk around a little bit in that early recovery, but it was something that took my mind off it. But I think one of the biggest, the best way for me to describe sort of how this feels is the type of holidays I used to go on. And I'm sure a lot of surfers can kind of relate to this, but before the attack, I would not be able to go on holidays somewhere where there wasn't a chance of me surfing. I wouldn't be able to go to a landlocked country. I wouldn't be able to go somewhere unless there was the chance that I was going to be surfing at some stage. Like, I would never travel without a board bag.
I was going to say,
The first trip I went
on. Just in case.
Yeah, just in case, at least. The first trip I went on after the attack was to the south of France for my sister's wedding, something I would have gone to anyway. But because I wasn't thinking the whole time about, you know, oh, I can't wait to get back and surf, or maybe we'll stop here on the way home and go for a wave. Because I was just focused on being in that moment, enjoying the culture and the country and all the sights and everything there, it got me to realize that by having the view I had before, I was basically going on holidays in these locations and neglecting the rest of the world.
Everything else. Yeah.
It's a very narrow way to look at things. And I think that's probably been one of the biggest things I've learned along the way. And the best way of describing how, you know, when we do have these things that are a big part of our lives, it's great if we can focus on something and make that, you know, a big part of us, but it's very easy to get absorbed in that and forget about everything else. And there are so many other important things that are a part of life that we can find joy and pleasure and happiness in. And that's something that I've definitely learned along the way.
It's a beautiful statement. It's a beautiful way to be.
It definitely helps. It definitely helps. And that was bred more just out of necessity of, well, I can't think about surfing at the moment, so how else can I look at this? And it's something that now I look at places that don't have waves to go on holidays to almost get away from it.
Yeah. what are you doing with your life now? And I know the movie's coming out this year sometime. So tell us a little bit about that and I'll wrap up.
Yeah. So a big focus for me, like I said just before, is sharing my story with the hopes of helping other people. So I do that through speaking, sharing my story, whether it be on podcasts or keynotes, things like that.
Yeah.
I am working on a documentary, sort of aiming to release October, November this year, which will document my story, not only just from my point of view, but the point of view of others as well. I say it is my story, but other people that are involved in it are just as important. Things like Joel, Aggie, my parents, my physio, those parts of my story, which really aren't mine to tell. So it's to share those, to go through the attack, the recovery. But then the final piece is the Molokai paddle that I mentioned before, which for people who don't know, is a 52-kilometer open ocean paddle between two islands in Hawaii. It's something that I shouldn't be able to do. Another sort of physical limitation thing. The operation that they did to save my leg was they took a lat muscle from my back and transplanted.
That's why you shouldn't be able to paddle. Yeah, okay.
So, yes, paddling should be a very big challenge and something that I shouldn't be able to do, but that's kind of the last part of the story that I want to document because it does really sum up a lot of things that I have kind of come across and learned over the last 6 years. And it's been a really big reason for waiting 6 years after the attack to make something like this, because it's hard to say when your story's done.
Yeah, because I don't think it's ever done.
I don't think so, but there's always so much you can learn. And I think having that paddle as kind of the last hurdle to overcome to get my story to a point where I really want to share it to people is a big part of it. So the film itself is called Pyrophytic Film. Mm-hmm. Which is a challenging title for a lot of people. So I do break down what it means. Pyrophytic species of plant, they're pretty common in Australia, species of plant that requires fire in order to germinate and regrow. So obviously runs pretty parallel to my story, the shark attack being the fire, but everything I've gone through since then is kind of regrowing. And you look at those amazing trees and the wildlife we have out there, which are pyrophytic species, you see them flourishing after those fires. And I think it's a really beautiful way to think about my story. And I'm really excited to finish that project off and have something that everyone can watch.
Absolutely.
So that's taking, a lot of my time at the moment. Yeah, which is good. I'm happy with that.
Do you need any help with getting over to Hawaii, or is that sorted out with sponsorship and that sort of thing?
No, we're always looking at sort of a bit of support for the film. We have been doing a lot of it just off sort of our own back at the moment. But
where can people help you out if they want to?
To be honest, just to get in touch. You can find my details or
on Instagram,
on any social media. I've also got a website which is just www.brettcanellan.com, which has contact info and an email there. So if anyone was interested in chatting. Obviously more than happy to, but that whole side of things has been, I suppose, interesting for me, because for me it's more just about sharing my story, and there's so many other things you have to do to get a documentary produced and in front of people. So
but there's nothing wrong with asking for help to do those sorts of things, because
definitely
the way I see it is that if someone wants to help monetary wise, that's not a bad thing, because we, in order for you to be able to do and produce the best thing that you want to do and help the most people that you want to, that's their way of helping you in that process.
Yeah, that's it. And that's, I suppose, where I look at what I'd love to do in the future is to help other people tell their story. And hopefully after doing this documentary, will give us a bit of a launching pad to do a few more of these in the future, which will be amazing.
I'm sure it will. And once that goes live, I'll let people know on the podcast here as well, so they can watch and support that as well. Thank you so much for being with me today, Brett.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Amongst the Waves. I would love for you to leave your review on Apple Podcasts. Reviews help increase our rankings, let more people listen to the podcast, and share the love.